Good afternoon. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is apparently May the 11th, 2022, although in some parts of the world, it's apparently May 12th, 2022, but we'll figure that out later. This is one more of our ongoing series of podcasts, and this afternoon, I have the great privilege, the distinct honor, and the memorable opportunity to be joined by three of my colleagues at SEAT, as in seatnow.org, as in the moral imperative of stop extraterritorial American taxation now. And with me today, Laura Snyder, Dr. Laura Snyder, Dr. Karen Alpert, and Keith Redman. And today is sort of an educational podcast. This is a topic that is, I would say, almost completely ignored in the world of global mobility, immigration, et cetera. And what we're going to be talking about today is, wouldn't you know, there are some things that anybody who is considering getting a permanent resident visa in the United States, that is an immigrant visa, AKA green card, absolutely must think about before it's too late. Well, welcome everybody. Welcome Laura. Welcome Karen. Welcome Keith. What do you think? Good topic?
Yeah, thanks John for having us.
Yes, excellent topic.
Yeah. Thanks John. It's a great topic.
Yes. So I think what prompted this is there are a lot of people who, you know, contact us and say, oh no, I've got a green card and they're doing this to me. Help. And so we thought it would be useful to kind of summarize things that you should do before you actually move to the US with a green card. So, you know, most people see that green card as just, okay, I've got the right to live in the US, right? But it's a lot more, because once you become a US tax resident, you are subject to complete US taxation on everything you own everywhere in the world, whether you bought it before you became a US resident or not. And all your current and future assets end up being in the US system as long as you hold that green card.
Oh my God. Absolutely frightening.
And so if you don't consider this properly, you could have punitive taxation on your non-US assets. So really, I think if we cut to the chase, the point is that green cards are very difficult and maybe even not suitable for people who are already financially established outside of the US.
Is there a reason they call them green cards, do you think?
What would you say, John?
Well, you know, I like to keep my worldview simple. The word kryptonite comes to mind.
It can be for certain expats in the United States. Absolutely. I was just going to add on to what Karen was saying. You know, when I'm on the ground in Washington, D.C., you know, it's ripe with a lot of expatriates from other countries. And I have, you know, acquaintances and friends in the expat community. And I tell you, this type of podcast would be a, if I may use the term, godsend for them, because a lot of people have not considered the ramifications before even considering a green card, especially if they're not foreseeing themselves living in the United States for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. So that means you have to have your whole life planned out before you decide to get a green card.
Well, you better be careful what you wish for. That's for sure.
For sure. So I think one of the things that people don't understand is that a lot of different tax systems they're very different. So John, maybe you could tell me how the US tax system differs from what people might be used to in their home countries.
Oh my God, there's nothing like the US tax system. And I think that we would start with, actually how tax residency is defined. And by tax residency, what I mean is, what are the rules that a country uses to determine whether it's subject to the full force of their tax system, whatever that may be. And what's interesting about the United States definition of tax residency is that, like many US laws, it begins with a sweeping proclamation. And that proclamation is, every individual, and by that they mean any conceivable carbon life form, probably include your dog, but they haven't tried to enforce it yet, is subject to US worldwide taxation. That's exactly what it says in section 1 of the Internal Revenue Code. And then what it does, it creates an exception that says, well, we're going to give you a break if you're a non-resident alien. Now, this is extremely significant because every other tax system I've ever seen begins with a definition of what it means to be a tax resident generally. You know, sometimes that will be number of days in the place. Sometimes it might be domicile. But you have to trip the wire in that respect. For the U.S. system, it's everybody's in. And the only way you get out, all right, is if you can show you're a non-resident alien. And I would.
And so let's unpack that just a bit, John, because non-resident alien is kind of a technical term.
That not everybody knows. Yeah.
It's defined in the US tax code. And relevant to this particular discussion, what does a non-resident alien, does a non-resident alien include someone who has a green card in their back pocket but is living in Paris?
Absolutely not. The definition of non-resident alien, for those who are keeping score, is in section 7701B6 of the Internal Revenue Code. And basically, it's anybody who is not a citizen of the United States or a resident, okay? And residence for tax purposes is defined there. Anybody who has a green card is absolutely positively a U.S. tax resident, continues to be a U.S. tax resident until that green card is either handed in under the immigration rules, I-407, is taken from them because they have done bad things, or they're able to make use of a tax treaty between the United States and another country. Those are the only three ways that once that green card has been handed to them or awarded to them, depending on their point of view, that they can cease to be a U.S. tax resident. And this is extremely important because there are untold numbers of green card holders who simply move from the United States and imagine that because they have moved, because they no longer live there, because they no longer have anything to do with the place, that therefore they're no longer U.S. tax residents. And that, of course, is completely wrong.
So my understanding is that with a green card, the green card loses effect for immigration purposes, once you no longer intend to live in the U.S. and you've moved away and haven't, you know, followed all of their instructions. But you're telling me that that is not enough to cut the tax tie.
Oh, I'm not only telling you, I'm telling everybody who's listening to this, and they better listen, because frankly, that's one of the most significant messages here that people need to understand. Now, I think another way of looking at this, and this is not true of just the United States, is that there is generally a difference between tax residency, what's required to be, you know, subject to a country's tax system, and immigration or citizenship status. Okay, so for example, as you know, I live in Canada, and one can have the status of permanent resident of Canada, but not be a tax resident of Canada, you know, et cetera. That is not true if you have a green card. Now, I understand for, you know, listeners that it is possible to use a tax treaty to, you know, break out of that in certain circumstances, but you can only use a tax treaty tiebreaker if you agree that you are a U.S. tax resident, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So no particular, you know, the fact of either having the U.S. immigrant visa, the green card for immigration purposes or not, is absolutely not determinative of tax residency.
Okay. So the other thing is just that the way the U.S. tax system works, once you're in it, is different from, say, how the tax system in, say, France or Australia or Canada might work. So some of the differences, like, how do you decide what's taxable? So, like, in Australia, if I went and won the lottery, that would not be a taxable event. How about in France, Laura? Would that be taxable if you won the lottery?
No.
You don't know. Okay. But
no, I don't believe it is taxable in France.
Yeah.
I made an educated guess that it's not, but honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not taxable in Canada. In fact, there are Canadians who gamble for a living.
Yeah. So, well, I'm sure there's every nationality who gambles for a living. The other thing is, if I were to sell my personal residence here in Australia, 100% of the gain would be exempt from Australian tax. Is that the same in France if you sell your personal residence?
Your primary residence, you don't pay capital gains tax on.
Right. Whereas in the US, they give you a $250,000 exemption, but anything over that is taxed. So right. I think it's important for people moving into the U.S. tax system to understand that the scope of what will be taxed may very well differ from what you're used to. And you can't just walk in and say, oh, well, this wasn't taxable in Australia or in France or wherever. Therefore, it must not be. I don't need to report it on my U.S. tax return.
Yeah, I just checked. I just checked and no, lottery winnings aren't generally,
right.
I think there's some exceptions, but generally they're not taxable in France. But I think the underlying message there isn't about any specific type of income.
Right.
It's about the fact that it often happens that income in one country is not taxable, whereas the US does tax it.
Yeah.
So basically the US basic general rule is if you're better off, it's taxable. If your net worth has gone up, it's taxable.
Taxable, right.
Right?
It's important to know that.
Right. And I think this is a very, very important point to add on to the, now remember the US definition of tax residency is everybody in the world is a US tax resident unless specifically excluded by being a non-resident alien. It's a similar sort of thinking about income. Every form of income, basically every increase in net worth, okay, is considered to be income. Now, not all of that is, you know, in the case of net worth, at the present time, it has to be realized, okay? But the whole point is that every benefit, all right, is considered to be taxable unless specifically excluded, right? So, you know, a common exclusion would be gifts and bequests, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, all forms of income, all forms of anything taxable, okay? And then if you look at the scheme of the Internal Revenue Code, there are specific carve-outs, right? This isn't taxable, that isn't taxable, et cetera. And again, I think the presumptions here are important because where we are with the U.S. tax system is everybody's subject to it, everything is included in it. And interestingly, the U.S. also has state and gift taxes, right? And employment taxes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and, you know, odd. Sometimes I've heard people say the U.S. tax is only one thing, everything.
Yeah. And then the other thing that you have to keep in mind is that the U.S. taxes, I mean, this may seem like pretty basic point, but everything's in US dollars. Even right. If you're, you know, you bought it before you became a US resident, we're going to go back and figure out what the US dollar value of this asset was when you bought it to figure out your gain. So everything is in US dollars, even if that's not the main currency that you're using to run your life.
Well, you know, Karen, another way of viewing that would be, would be this, that from a U.S. perspective, the only currency in the world is the U.S. dollar. And anything else is really just a commodity, right? It's like buying a bushel of wheat or something, you know, that goes up and down in value relative to the U.S. dollar, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody taxable on everything. And the only currency there is in the world is the U.S. dollar. Okay, let's keep track.
Yeah. And then the other thing is what your tax period is. So in Australia, we do our taxes for the financial year that ends June 30th. But the U.S. uses a calendar year. And that's probably a minor point for most people, but it's just something to keep in mind.
It's not a minor point, Karen. When one of the Biden proposed tax changes is to disallow the carry backwards of foreign tax credits for a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this has been very, very topical. I don't know that it is today, but I recall, sort of around December or something, you know, there was a lot of discussion about this, but absolutely, we've got a lack of congruence, if you will, between the use of the calendar year and the use of other years, et cetera, yep. You know, which will complicate this as well.
Yeah. And then the other point in terms of how the U.S. tax system is different is that the number of forms that are required is just over the top. And a lot of them information forms returns that don't have anything to do with what your calculation of tax, but they want to know everything about your financial life. And with each of those forms, especially if they are reporting foreign assets, there are penalties that start at about $10,000 US.
Right, and some of them are indexed to inflation. You know, FBAR penalties, I think is stated to be a $10,000 penalty.
So, for our audience, John, what is FBAR?
Well, it depends on your point of view. It stands for Foreign Bank Account Report, meaning foreign, by the way, means anything that's not U.S. It comes from 1970. Mr. FBAR was born in 1970. And
sometime in the 70s, they set the threshold at, or maybe it was in the 80s, they set the threshold at 10,000. The threshold of $10,000 is not indexed, but the penalty is.
Absolutely, yeah. Right, because the whole point is to subject more and more people to penalties. See, if you look at the U.S. tax system, I don't think it should be called a tax system. I think that it includes taxes, but it's largely a regulatory and reporting system. You mentioned the sheer number of forms, and we'll talk about how that becomes magnified when you're dealing with anything that is not U.S. But I think that what people need to understand is that when you become a U.S. tax resident, either by being born there or by getting a green card, I think you need to live according to one simple principle. And that is report early, report often, report everything, and by God, keep a record of everything you report. Because any of these omissions is opening the door to, you know, extraordinary penalties, extraordinary. I mean, think of, you know, all the people who you presumably know in Australia who were hit with those, you know, those crazy 35-20A penalties, you know, a couple of years ago. I mean, this is... I think that part of the problem is that, you know, we talk about different tax systems. And I actually am inclined to think the U.S. tax system is more about reporting than about tax. And that is, you know, is very, very different from, you know, from other tax systems. But where this is, you know, why does this matter for green card holders? Well, it's because a lot of people who want to get permanent residence in the United States, particularly the ones who are going this EB-5 route, right? Which is the residence by investment sort of a program in the United States, are looking to get these green cards. But because these cost about $1 million, these people often have significant foreign, non-US assets, meaning foreign assets, you know, or pensions or things like that. And they get the green card, they're not gonna get rid of these other assets. I mean, These are things that may have been in their family for generations. But, you know, if they don't report these things properly, even, you know, even if they're not necessarily generating income every year to the U.S. government, I mean, they're subject to massive, massive penalties. And it's very, very difficult to, you know, to fix these omissions. And, you know, I think that anybody should be clear-headed and try to get objective advice before getting a green card, all right? But anybody who has any significant net worth or is living from a pension, which may not be taxable, right, in the country they live in. I mean, there's, you know, untold numbers of people who immigrate to Canada or the United States and all of a sudden find out their pensions are taxable, right, at high rates.
Right. Yes.
So, John, when if one is a prospective green card holder, is looking to get a green card and needs this type of tax advice to be proactive, where would they go? What type of professional would they need to look for vis-a-vis criteria to ensure that they're getting good information?
Well, I think the first thing is that if they're getting a green card and it's sort of a family, I think that they send one of the children to law school in the United States. You know, the U.S., the world of the United States with 50 states and all these crazy laws and everything, you know, you can't survive unless you have a lawyer in the family. I mean, it's sort of like, what's that word they use in a mafia crime family, the consigliori or something? I mean, you know, you know, everybody has to have that to survive. But presuming that, you know, they don't have, you know, somebody, I think that they need, what I think I would do is this, okay? You know, so let's pick a country, say France, for just because two of you are from France here today. I don't know a great deal about France, but I have been told that France has taxes.
They do.
I've even been told that they have a, you know, rather brutal taxes, okay? Mm. So here's the thing, right? If you're a wealthy Frenchman and you have a lot of French assets and you want to move to the United States, I think that what you ought to do first is actually get an appointment with somebody who understands what it means to be a U.S. tax resident while owning a large portfolio of French assets, right, or non-U.S. assets, and say, well, hey, you know, what would this mean in terms of an ongoing, you know, compliance or tax base? Now, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about here is how punitively the U.S. does tax non-U.S. assets. You know, for example, non-U.S. Mutual funds or, you know, if you had a small business corporation, God forbid, you know, so you have to understand, you know, it's interesting. Not only do you have to understand how your income streams would be taxed that are U.S. income streams, but more importantly, you need to understand how your non-U.S. income streams and non-U.S. assets are sort of run through, you know, the whole U.S. financial system. And, you know, and of course, what the reporting requirements are. Now, you know, so what I don't think is that your basic tax, I think that's way beyond the competence of your basic, you know, tax.
Yeah, so you're not going to a simple U.S. tax preparer.
No, absolutely not. Where I would start would be a high-end tax preparer in your country of residence who also understands U.S. taxes, right? Because, you know, it's important to understand both systems. So you have that. You know, one of the problems with life is financial planning, right? I think it's become, you know, probably a, you know, fundamental obligation. And it's very, very difficult for U.S. tax residents, be they citizens, green card holders, to engage in normal, responsible financial planning, you know, if they have, you know, non-U.S. assets and that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, a financial planner, I know that, you know, Karen is very much a believer in this, and I agree with her. You know, so you need somebody, you know, who can navigate those types of things. Thirdly, you know, there's what I would call pre-immigration planning. And by that, I mean, what do you think it might be a good idea to get rid of before you become a U.S. tax resident? Okay. Now,
good point.
Let me give you some basic examples here. You know, there are countries that don't have capital gains taxes, right? Now, let's imagine that, you know, you've had a piece of property for 30 years or whatever, and you're about to go to the United States And let's say if you were to sell it where before you become a U.S. tax resident, you're not going to be subject to capital gains tax in your country of residence. Maybe you want to get rid of that. Because if you arrive with that in the United States and sell it as a U.S. tax resident, I know this is hard for people to believe, but they're going to tax the whole gain right from the moment that you acquired the asset, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is incredibly important. You know, there's the whole issue of setting up trusts. I mean, that's a very technical area, but I'll give you something to remember, 5-year rule. Okay, if you're going to set up trusts, you want to do it more than 5 years out before becoming a U.S. tax resident. So, you know, otherwise they're going to treat these trusts as what are called grantor trusts, meaning that they're going to, you know, the U.S. tax rules will attribute the income earned inside the trust to you personally. You know, I mean, you know, there's a variety of things. The whole issue of not of businesses, you know, how will U.S. tax, you know, an ongoing business? And this is a very, very serious matter.
And I think there's another way to look at what you're describing. It's the same thing, but from another perspective. If you think about Americans who are living overseas, who are married to people who are married in a family that is mainly not U.S. citizens, they generally find themselves excluded from holding a lot of these family assets. They're not on the title to their house. They're not a shareholder in the business. You know, they're not holders of the whatever PFIX, whatever investments there might be, in order to avoid all these U.S. tax consequences. And I think you can safely predict that a non-citizen who's seeking a green card is going to find themselves not just needing to ask themselves what of their own assets maybe they need to think about getting rid of, but contemplate to the extent they do or may hold family assets, that's going to end. They're going to be excluded from that, or you know, you could argue that from that family's perspective, they should be excluded from holding any of those assets once they decide to have a green card.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, there are attribution rules, you know, between spouses. Maybe they want to get a divorce, you know, to avoid some of these problems, et cetera. I mean, you know, I'm actually half serious on this, right? You know, these are big problems. And the point here is not that everybody's going to have all these problems.
Right.
Or that anybody's going to have any of them necessarily, because, you know, if you go to the United States penniless, you know,
as a young guy or gal,
you know, like the mythology of the old days where, you know, you take the ship in and see the statue, you know, the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, I think these days it's more you go to the U.S. and get a master's degree or some other graduate degree and just stay.
Right.
Well, let me just talk about that for a second, okay, and how that can lead to really serious problems, right? We talk about tax residency. Well, I mean, the U.S. is insane, but, you know, but not totally insane in the sense that you can go to the U.S. as a student.
Right.
And, you know, you can spend more than, you know, the substantial presence test, right? You spend enough time there, you know, you become a U.S. tax resident. It's not just green card holders. There are a number of ways to be qualify as a resident. But if you're a student under certain kinds of visas, all right, you know, you don't become a tax resident generally, okay, at least for a while, as long as you are a student. But here's an interesting thing I've seen from over the years. You know, we talk about children of wealthy families. They go to the U.S. as students, and then they stay. Well, so then they become U.S. tax residents, right? But their parents, you know, may own businesses outside the United States, right?
Right.
And so through the attribution rules, they pick up, you know, these horrendous reporting requirements. I mean, if you can imagine, right? And, you know, this is a frightening, ridiculous sort of thing. So in other words, and I've seen this, you know, a number of times in different contexts, is where the immigration status changes, right? And they're no longer, you know, a student or, you know, they came on one visa, but they stayed long enough. So all of a sudden they're a U.S. tax resident. They meet the residency requirements. Then they're subject to the worldwide tax regime, which includes all the reporting requirements, which then can suck in, right? you know, things that they never even imagined could be subject to, you know, the U.S. reporting regime. You know, foreign brokerage accounts, foreign bank accounts, you know, they wake up one day and it's good morning. Today is your first day of being subject to the U.S. worldwide tax regime. And congratulations, you've just subjected yourself to $100,000 of penalties.
Yeah. So this might be a good time to kind of go through the types of assets that that are particularly problematic. So if you've just got a bank account, that's, you know, there's reporting requirements. That's not so bad.
Right.
But because there's no special tax rules for bank accounts. Real estate. What's real estate going to do if you own, say, a rental property in France? How's that going to affect your U.S. tax?
That's generally, as far as I can see, fairly safe. Real estate is not, I believe, unless you know anybody here says something to the contrary, considered to be a foreign financial asset.
No, it's not a financial
form, yeah, purposes of Form 8938 or for FBAR reporting, et cetera.
I think I don't want to unnecessarily complicate it, but if you want to use France as a specific example, sometimes it's advised under French rules, if you're going to invest in real estate, to hold it under a specific type of corporate entity.
Right.
That I understand creates all sorts of problems. Under
absolutely.
US
absolutely.
Under U.S.
Yeah,
law.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, if you're going to have real estate what happens outside is this, the U.S., right? It should be directly owned.
I think it's important that this be understood, though. All right. So, you know, if you own it directly, that's one thing of a certain consequence. But if it's owned by, let's say, a corporation, all right, then you don't own the asset, you own the share in the corporation. And the share in the corporation becomes the foreign financial asset, right? Mm-hmm. Or put into a trust, right? Then there are very specific reporting rules, you know, surrounding trust. So it's important that the, you know, no pun intended, but the form of the ownership be considered because, you know, I mean, a lot of places, you know, these things, you know, are seen as basically one and the same. But generally speaking, if real estate is owned personally, it's not going to create like a Form 89338 requirement. However, remember that if we get to the issue of estate taxes and things like that, right, then it does become part of the whole equation. Or, you know, if somebody gets a green card, I would expect we're going to talk about expatriation, you know, then that sort of thing becomes an asset for the purpose of determining the net worth test as well. So.
Right. So directly owned real estate is relatively benign. Investments can be, and especially retirement savings can be a real problem, can't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, I know that this is sort of, you know, an area where I think, Karen, you've carved out a very specific expertise, you know, in the whole area of mutual funds and that sort of stuff. But, you know, non-U.S. mutual funds are considered by the United States to be nothing but sacred instruments of tax evasion.
They're pretty toxic because the U.S. Defines them as passive foreign investment companies. So any foreign, non-U.S. company where the majority of the income is dividends, interest, passive income, the U.S. has a very brutal taxation and reporting. And it's not just reporting. It's basically the elimination of the ability to use the capital gains rules effectively.
That's right. And this is, this is an incredibly serious compliance issue for untold numbers of Americans abroad. It probably affects, you know, Americans abroad more. But I think that the principle, right, this is very complicated. But I think that if one remembers the following very simple principle, okay, and there's two sorts of sides to it, right? The first is the U.S. absolutely hates anything foreign. okay, a pure hatred. And the second is that if you see the word foreign in the Internal Revenue Code, in all likelihood, you're going to see the word penalty in the next four or five words, generally starting at about $10,000.
Right. Okay. So mutual funds are toxic. What about retirement savings?
Depends on the form of the savings, right? And, you know, whether they, you know, whether they've been taxed or not. I mean, if you have something that's sort of the equivalent of a Roth IRA, you know, that's already been, you know, subject to tax where you are, you know, then really you're looking at taxation on the income, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I would think. And, you know, and getting getting something, make a distribution from that, I guess it's treated as either interest dividend or capital gain.
Part of the difficulty is that the U.S. certainly has retirement accounts, but they're all specified in the Internal Revenue Code. And so if what you have in Australia or in France or wherever, it hasn't been organized so that it meets all of those definitions in the U.S. Internal Revenue Code, then it's something else, and who knows what. And everybody's, or the US tax code is trying to shoehorn it into something that looks American. And how to do that becomes very, very difficult and very expensive.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, you know, there's two points here. Okay. The first is that the only retirement, the only legitimate, in the same way, the only currency is the US dollar. Everything else is just fake, right? All right. The only retirement plans would be U.S. retirement plans, okay, as a general principle, although, you know, I suppose that there's the 402B thing. Now, many tax treaties, I know not in Australia, all right, make an effort to deal with this by, you know, defining or by agreeing that if it qualifies as a pension in a certain way, you know, then it's going to get the same treatment as, say, a U.S. pension would. For example, the RRSP in Canada, you know, it's going to get similar treatment.
So it's a handful of countries, not a very, right. Not very many.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, the ones that come to mind are, you know, Canada and the U.K. And once you get beyond that, you know, you've got trouble. Although my memory is that Germany has a fairly...
Yeah, Germany's not too bad.
The point is this, it's the starting point, right? You know, the starting point is not one of safety, right? The starting point is denial of its status as a pension plan.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, taxing it as though it's not, which generally means running it through the anti-deferral regime.
Yeah, I've heard from several people who've gone over to the U.S. from Australia for green cards after retiring. Their Australian retirement is tax-free here, and the U.S. wants to treat it all as income. And that's a significant hit for someone who's living off of something that they thought was going to be tax-free.
Well, you know, absolutely. This is a gigantic problem. This is a worldwide problem. It's not just the United States, although
we need a multilateral retirement income treaty.
Absolutely. There has got to be something, because at this point, among the group of people who actually understand these rules, right, or understand there are rules like this, even though whether they understand them or not, I mean, these are real, real barriers to personal mobility. They are barriers to being able to move, right?
Absolutely.
They're a way of trapping people inside one country. I mean, you know, look at the situation of U.S. citizens. They're effectively trapped in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think wrote that wonderful article, it was the criminalization of the American immigrant. Was that what it was called?
That's what it's called, John.
The criminalization of the American immigrant.
And if you get a green card, you're going to join that club.
Exactly. The fast track to becoming a criminal. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so retirement savings are a problem. What about business interests? You're running a business where you live now, and then you become a green card holder, what happens to that foreign business?
Oh my God. I mean, this is probably the worst of all possible worlds. Well, first of all, the first question is, what is it?
Okay. Exactly. Is it a corporation? Is it a trust?
Exactly. And, you know, and the fact is, I don't mean this in a, you know, derogatory or pejorative way, but I doubt that more than 5% of CPAs in the United States have any experience with that issue at all. You know, so the first question is, what is it? And if it becomes, whether it becomes a corporation or a trust, you're headed for trouble either way. But, and the basic principle of the trouble is this, okay? The principle, although it's done in different ways, is that, you know, there's only one reason that somebody would have a corporation or a trust, and that's obviously to try to remove income from the U.S. tax system. I mean, why else would you do it, right? And the way we're going to get at that is we're going to say, well, we're going to look inside that corporation. We're going to say, that corporation made money. And you know what? We're going to have the individual shareholder put that money. We're going to tax them personally on it, on their own tax return, even though they never received it. So, you know, this is part of the problem.
There are certain elections you can make to make it a disregarded entity that might, and those you have to do like right away. So that, you need to know before you become a US resident.
Karen, you want to know something incredible? In Canada, all right, all things that are called corporations are treated as corporations per se, meaning that no election is possible.
Right.
The exception of some kind of Nova Scotia company that I'd never heard of till I started this. So I mean, to put this in perspective, because of that completely idiotic, moronic decision, I mean, why all the Canadian companies, only some Australian companies, right?
The only public Australian companies are
personally. Right. You know, you can make an election. But to put it in perspective, so that means that all these Canadian companies somehow became subject to the transition tax. I mean, you know,
what this highlights, John, is that any advice you get about moving to the U.S. and becoming a U.S. tax resident is highly, highly country specific.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
So the advice that you see that's been given to an Australian isn't going to help you if you're in Canada.
Yeah, I would say that is generally true. I think the principles are useful to listen to, but, you know, I agree. You need very, very specific advice. And I keep coming back to, I think that the best advisors in this area, and I don't think that the world is exactly full of them, okay? But I think that the best advisors are probably, you know, people who are experts in Canada, Australia, the UK, whatever, but are also experts in the US tax system, all right? I think, you really need both. You know, if you have any assets at all, and unfortunately, I don't think the threshold is all that high. You know, in terms of people's assets. And I think that, I think that becoming a U.S. tax resident is extremely risky and it needs to be understood.
And so the one asset class we haven't covered yet is trusts. I mean, we've mentioned it briefly, but.
What is a trust, Karen?
Yeah, so, you know, question, even if it's called a trust where you live, doesn't mean the U.S. considers it a trust.
Absolutely right. So what does that mean, if I can just add something here? So in Canada, you know, a common financial planning vehicle is called a TFSA, tax-free savings account. And all it is, it's a bank account with a tax wrapper that says, you know, if you throw money into this, subject to limits every year, you know, you're not subject to taxation on the interest. Now, under the Income Tax Act of Canada, like the United States, Canada's constitution is the Income Tax Act of Canada. America's constitution is an Internal Revenue Code. But, you know, what they've done is they have defined it through the use of the word trust. Okay. So, of course, initially all these tax preparers in Canada, oh my God, look, it's called a trust in Canada. Therefore, we're going to treat it as a trust. An absolutely fatal decision. Absolutely fatal. Because once you're treating it as a trust, and by the way, if you treat it as a trust and you file that way with the IRS, they're going to call you up and say, excuse me, sir, you made a mistake. This isn't a trust. No, they're going to get excited because they think they can levy penalties, right?
Okay. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a very specific definition of what a trust includes in the Treasury regulations. This is not found in the Internal Revenue Code. It's found in the Treasury regulations, which really are arguably an even more important part of, you know, the U.S. tax regime. And I don't remember the exact definition, but it has something to do with, it includes, you know, taking control of the property to conserve it, you know, that sort of thing. It's sort of a an old common law or chancery definition of trust. But my point is, it is not, TFSA does not qualify. Okay.
And for the most part, a self-managed super fund over here in Australia would not.
I agree with you on that completely, Karen. But I suspect
a lot of tax professionals do treat them as trusts.
They do. I know they do. I think they're making a mistake. But, you know, I'm not a tax preparer, right? So I can make these proclamations.
Okay, so let's move on to getting rid of the green card. And what kind of problems can you run into when you get rid of a green card? So you hand it in, you're no longer a U.S. tax resident. Easy, go home, be done, right?
Well, you know, Karen, U.S. tax resident is sort of like, you know, what do they say about getting an expensive boat or a plane? The two best days are the day you get it and the day you get rid of it. Okay. Now, the problem is that the U.S. Has very, very punitive exit taxes. Okay. You do not leave.
So if I get a green card and then leave the next year, am I going to be subject to the exit tax?
No, the U.S. is a fair, just nation. It doesn't subject everybody to the exit tax unless you're a U.S. citizen, of course, who's never lived in the United States. No, you have to be what's called a long-term resident. And a long-term resident means you've had the green card for 8 of the previous 15 years before you hand it in. And
that's 8 partial years even.
You know what? If you woke up for 1 second as a green card holder, if you woke up and looked over and saw your green card, that's it. Okay? Anything.
Even so that year's gone.
A year. So really, it's 6 years and 2 seconds.
Yep.
6 years and 2 seconds. But the good news is that if you're smart enough to, within that first 8 years, to go back to a country that has a tax treaty with the U.S. and take a tax treaty tie break, which is beyond the scope of this discussion, but worth considering, that year would not count towards one of the 8 years.
Yeah. Okay. So once you've hit the 8 years, you have this exit tax. But even if you hit the 8 years, you're not necessarily going to pay anything, are you?
Well,
there's three tests you got to meet before we even start calculating a tax, right?
That is right. Okay. You know, the three tests are, one, you have to have a net worth of over $2 million, and that's worldwide assets. Okay.
And that's not indexed. So as inflation goes, you know, in 20 years, that's going to be, yeah, you have a house. I mean, even now you have a house.
that's about all it takes at this point, honestly. So yeah, there's that. There's, you know, U.S. citizenship residence is really about taxation. So, you know, if you can't certify tax compliance for the 5 previous years, you're subject to the exit tax. And the third would be, you know, if your U.S. tax bill for each of the 5 previous years was, I think it's 170,000 or more, which,
and that is indexed.
That is indexed, and that's a lot of money, but it's
for not a tax liability.
That's tax liability, but you know, I see a lot of people who are there. I mean, you know, it's amazing how high you know, incomes are in certain areas. You know, certain you know, the tech area. You know, it's not hard to do. Okay, it's not hard to do, and that's why, you know, planning is extremely important. But I would also say, so you know, you trip any one of those wires, you're going to be subject to the exit tax. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll pay an exit tax, okay? Because, you know, there's 3 different kinds of exit taxes. But there's a deemed sale of property, you get a $700,000 exclusion. But where are we?
Okay, so let's unpack that really briefly. On the day that you lose that green card for tax purposes, the IRS is going to assume that you sold everything for US dollars. And they're going to calculate your capital gain. And if that capital gain is less than $750,000, they're not going to there's no exit tax. The first 750,000 is,
well,
roughly
no exit tax on the part of the exit tax that relates to deemed sales, but there's more. Right. I would also say,
but there's, yeah,
you know, that it's proportionally rated over different asset classes. But yeah, so we have that.
And if you're selling assets that you held at the time you got the green card, are we going to go all the way back in history to find out what they originally cost?
That's interesting. Okay. In the Internal Revenue Code, there's a very specific provision that says the basis, right? In other words, what you're deemed to have bought it for is the fair market value at the point that you got the green card. Okay, so in other words, let's say you owned a piece of property, it was worth $1 million. Then when you moved to the US, it was worth $2 million. And when you left, it was $3 million. The exit tax would be calculated on $3 million less $2 million, not $3 million less $1
million. Right.
Okay.
There's the assets that you own. We're going to calculate the capital gain, and from that we can subtract the exclusion of 700 and whatever thousand.
All right. Step one: are you covered expatriate? Step two: calculate the gain. Step three: subtract the 700,000.
Right, but then there's also other assets that might be taxable, like all deferred compensation.
Absolutely. This is unreal. Okay.
And there's no 750,000 exclusion for that.
That's right. And there's also no election to defer the tax. Okay. You can make an election to, I don't think you should, but you can make an election to defer the tax on the deemed sale.
Mm-hmm.
Specified tax deferred accounts, IRAs, that sort of stuff, right? They are treated as completely distributed. Okay, in other words, you received it, collapsed and distributed on that day. What does that mean from a tax point of view? It depends. You know, if it's a traditional IRA where basically you never pay tax on the money, it means that it's all included as income. So, you know, let's say you had a $500,000 IRA, you know, you hand in the green card, that $500,000 is deemed distributed. The third kind is the deferred compensation. These are far more complicated. But if they are, if they're U.S.-based deferred compensation, meaning a pension from a U.S. company or something, there's an election, all right, to basically not have the value of the asset subject to the exit tax, but wait until the distributions come out. And there's a set of rules that have to do with, you know, withholding taxes and things like that that you can file later and get back. But the point is, it's complicated, it's punitive, and you stand a good chance of losing something, okay?
Right.
So again, I'm not saying don't move to the USA. I think that there are opportunities there. But for people who already have assets, I'd be very, very cautious, very cautious.
Yeah, and I think you do see a lot of people, especially in these high paid tech agencies, who are looking at that 8-year rule and counting it very carefully.
They are. They sure are.
And moving out of the U.S., you know, before they're subject to these exit tax.
They talk about it, you know, among themselves. I mean, this is a very serious topic of discussion. And, you know, if anybody, U.S.
government, okay. Well,
this is bad for the United States.
Yeah, we've been going quite a while. It's probably time to start thinking about wrapping this up. So how would someone move forward? If they've decided that they really want to move to the U.S., they should, number one, consider whether a green card is the right visa to get, because other visas, non-immigrant visas, still give you the U.S. tax system, but you can walk away much easier.
It's only the green card that subjects you to the exit tax.
Right. But once you've decided that you really want to move to the U.S. for whatever reason, you need to find some sort of cross-border expert.
You need an advisor, okay?
And you need an advisor
who I think is based in the country where you're going to retain the assets, okay?
Yeah.
Right.
And I think for people who are listening to this, who are already in the U.S. contemplating it, they need to get that advisor about which you're speaking, John and Karen, but also keep in mind that generally speaking, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, immigration attorneys are not going to know anything about this. That's not their area specialty. They won't bring it up. It's not their area specialty. Exactly. So it's very important to do what you need to do to prepare vis-a-vis being in the U.S. tax system before you even contemplate getting a green card.
That is right. But I mean, fairness to immigration lawyers.
Yes.
That generally they don't know a lot about this, but it's the culture of legal practice also where, you know, I don't want to advise on something unless I consider myself to be an expert, right? But what they do need to be doing is saying, hey, you know what? I can help you get the right to live here, but boy, you better find out what it actually means to live here in terms of, you know, holding on to your assets and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And definitely don't rely on what you read on social media, because number one, every country is different. Number two, most of the people who are tweeting or writing on Facebook don't really know what they're talking about.
Well, it's worse than not knowing what they're talking about. Okay. It's that they can't even imagine that a lot of these issues exist. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the issues incorrectly, you know, but it's quite another, okay, to be talking as though these things don't exist at all. You know, it's a bad problem. I think people should think long and hard before getting a green card.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, well, I think we've covered all the items in our outline. So thank you, John and Laura and Keith. I think that was a very productive discussion.
Yeah, I think it was a good discussion. Well, thanks for narrating or moderating or guiding us.
Yeah. And it's a much needed discussion because it is not talked about at all. So this is very good.
I would even say that a lot of people, if you raise these issues with them, they would find it so crazy that they wouldn't want to even believe you.
yes.
And I think a discussion like this can help help people to understand it's true. It's crazy, but it's true.
It's true. Yeah, absolutely.
It is. And, you know, what I've come to see more and more is that the tax preparer should not be the advisor, right? You know, it's got to be, you know, much sort of broader view of this. But, you know, we can do a follow-up. I do think that this has been a valuable discussion. So thank you all for participating. Any closing words, Laura? What's happening with that Statue of Liberty?
Actually, if I was going to say one more thing, I would just follow up on what you just said, John, in terms of, you know, the people that prepare the tax returns aren't, I absolutely agree with you, aren't the right people to advise on these general issues. They won't necessarily point out the real problems. That's the only thing I would say in closing.
Aaron, anything else?
Yeah, I have nothing to add, John, but thank you.
Okay, this is great. One more of these podcasts. And again, this is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Karen Alpert from Australia, where she's always not only ahead of us intellectually, but you know, she's ahead of us. Laura, the beacon of liberty, has returned free recently. And of course, Keith, all right, who is keeping the world honest. All right. I guess thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.